Torah Jazz, Session 24, Parshas Chukas. There's a lot happening in this week's Parsha. What a surprise. We're going to be picking up a little bit in with the death of Miriam. In this Parsha, both Miriam and Aaron die. And of course, there's a decree against Moshe and Aaron from entering the land of Israel. So we're going to pick up in the middle, Chapter 20, Verse 1. The children of Israel, we're reading straight from the art scroll over here, the entire assembly arrived at the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people settled in Kadesh. Now let's just point out that when we say in the first month over here, we are referring to the first month of the last year that the Jewish people are in the desert. That means that they're on their way into the land of Israel. Look at that first Rashi over there. Miriam died there and she was buried there. There was no water for the assembly. Right away, we see that after Miriam dies, there's no water for the Jewish people. And from there, Rashi brings the Chazal, that we see that it was in the merit of Miriam that for the entire 40 years that the Jewish people were in the desert, the well, the Be'er Miriam, the water that was there solely in her merit. Okay, so Miriam dies. There's no water. The people are upset, obviously, because they're smart people, the Jewish people. They know that if they don't have water, they're going to die. So Hashem, Hashem's presence settles on the tent of assembly, the tent of meeting, and there the prophecy comes to Moshe saying the following. Okay, here we go. Back to the art scroll. We're in verse 7. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, "Take the staff and gather together the assembly, you and Aaron your brother, and you shall speak to the rock before their eyes, and it shall give its waters. You shall bring forth for them water from the rock and give drink to the assembly and their animals." Moshe took the staff from before Hashem as he commanded him. Moshe and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock and said to them, "Listen now, rebels, shall we bring forth water for you from this rock?" Then Moshe raised his arm and struck the rock with his staff twice. Abundant water came forth, and the assembly and their animals drank. Oh, and that should be a happy ending. Only, Hashem said to Moshe and to Aaron, "Because you did not believe in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you will not bring this congregation to the land that I have given them." Rashi points out that we see from the verse that were it not for this instance, Moshe and Aaron would have been in the land of Israel with the Jewish people. But it was this event that issued, that caused the issuance of the decree that they will not go into the land. And the question, of course, is, what did they do wrong? The people were thirsty. Hashem told them to get them water from the rock. They went to get the water from the rock. So in order to try to understand what happened, what went wrong, we're going to go back to the story, and there's going to be a few different approaches. And there's basically three moving pieces that we're going to have to keep our eye on. First of all, Hashem says to Moshe to go and speak to the rock. And ultimately, we don't see the occasion, at least in the continuation of the story, where Moshe speaks to the rock. Dibartim el hasela. Second of all, the fact that Moshe takes the staff with him, and Hashem commands him to take the staff with him, and when he hits the rock, the verse says he hit the rock twice. Now again, the Torah didn't tell us what outfit he was wearing, what day of the week it was, or what the weather was like. So if he hit the rock twice, that's going to be a significant piece of information. We're going to have to understand why he hit the rock twice. And then, of course, the speech in the middle, right? We're not sure where Moshe was asked to speak to the people, but all of a sudden in the middle, Moshe gives a soliloquy before striking the rock and says, "Listen now, rebels, shall we bring forth water for you from this rock?" Those are going to be the big three pieces we're going to be going around. First of all, now, let's just back to the rock. Now, if you were paying attention this year, you'll recall that we've done this before. And the time we did this was back in Parshas Bashalach. Now, in Bashalach, the people leave Egypt. And it happens a few times that they run into this problem that when you go into a desert, there's no water there. And apparently 7-Eleven hadn't been opened yet, so that wasn't an option either. So back there, eventually Moshe turns to Hashem and Hashem says, okay, go to the mountain at Mount Horeb, and this is just Moshe alone. Aaron's not involved over here. He tells Moshe to take 70 elders with him, take them to the spot where he'll see the divine presence there, to hit the rock, and then the water comes out. So the questions that generates is, of course, well, first of all, why do we need to do the same miracle twice? Did Hashem run out of tricks? He didn't have more miracles that he could have performed. He had to go back and do the water from the rock thing a second time. Why are we going through the water from the rock business again? Now, the other question is, what exactly went wrong this second time? Moshe hits the rock then, Moshe hits the rock now. If there's something that's fundamentally inappropriate with hitting a rock with your staff, then would have been problematic the first time as well. Why is it so problematic the second time? And the first time, it was the way to go. And third of all, the punishment for hitting the rock, if that's the problem, or whatever happened here, whatever we understand is the problem, we're really going to have to understand if it fits the crime, because this means that Moshe, who was the leader of the chosen people, who was meant to take them out from bondage into freedom, he was meant to take them all the way into the land of Israel. That was the ultimate destiny. It wasn't to stop in the desert. And now he does not get to complete his own destiny. What happened at this moment in time that was worse than anything that Moshe had ever done, that now Hashem says, that's it. No more. I had enough for you. No going into the land of Israel. And of course, that was just a dramatic recreation. Hashem didn't actually say that, and he doesn't sound like me. Okay, so Rashi is going to take the approach that the problem was that Hashem had asked Moshe to speak to the rock and not to hit it. There was some difference in the way this miracle was supposed to work. Moshe didn't get it right. He did it wrong. And apparently that was very, very bad. The Ramban asks the question, which was later rephrased by Simon and Garfunkel. Basically, a rock feels no pain, and an island doesn't cry. So what difference does it make to the rock if you hit it or talk to it? The rock doesn't know the difference. The people don't know the difference, right? Only Aaron and Moshe knew that they were meant to be speaking to this rock in Rashi's approach. More questions the Ramban has. Anytime we see the mate, the special staff, it means something's gonna get hit. Which is interesting because the Chumash doesn't always say that explicitly. But the Ramban's approach is even if it does not say it explicitly, anytime the staff is mentioned, it means something gonna get hit. Okay. So if the staff is showing up here, the Ramban understands this rock is supposed to get hit. So the Ramban's approach is going to be different than Rashi's approach. Rashi's approach, the big mistake was hitting and not speaking. The Ramban's approach is going to be not the problem of hitting, but rather the Ramban's problem is that he hits the rock twice. But the Ramban's going to have to answer some questions for us. We saw that the Parsha said that he needs to speak to the rock. How could the Ramban sort of glance over that as though Hashem hadn't said it? So it's interesting. If you look at the... I tried to point out the way the phrase is written in the Chumash over here. We're in verse number 8. Take the staff, gather the people, you and Aaron, your brother, v'dibartim el hasela, speak to the rock. The Ramban points out, he brings several precedences, that this phrase, el, right, this el ha, to the, could actually also be understood as al ha, about thee. And he has different examples throughout Tanakh where that's the case. So instead of talk to the rock, the Ramban understands this is talk about the rock. Now, rocks are not the most exciting thing in the world. I have met geologists. They're very nice people, but we do talk about other things than rock formations. Why is it so important for Moshe to speak about the rock? And the whole idea is, well, the whole idea as to why we're gathering all the people around this rock in the first place. Because we want to get them focused on the miracle. And therefore, when Moshe does that, when Moshe says, listen up, you rebels, yes, he's calling attention to those who were complaining about the water, and says, Hamina selazeh notzilechem maim. He doesn't read it like Rashi or the Ibn Ezra, that's a question. Shall we, right? Shall we bring forth water for you from this rock? Rather, it's a statement. Hamin hasela hazeh notzilechem maim. From this rock, we will bring forth water. That's to say, Hashem told them to speak about the rock. They gathered the people. They did exactly that. They spoke about the rock. They got their attention in the right place to prime them for this amazing miracle. So the problem for the Ramban is that Moshe, not that he hits the rock, but rather that he hits the rock twice. Now, if hitting the rock once is okay, why is hitting the rock twice a problem? So the Ramban's actually touching about an amazing point in Emuna. And as we go back to the end of this section that we were reading, Hashem does tell them, because you did not believe in me to sanctify me, Ya'an lo he'emantim bi lahakdisheni, right? There was some sort of lack of Emuna that created the problem in this event. So we have this concept called hishtadlus, that is to say, the basic effort a person has to take in all things in life. And even though it seems like an awful lot of fun, if I would roll out of bed in the morning and my cereal would jump into the bowl on its own, I don't know why I said cereal, I don't actually eat cereal for breakfast, but whatever, we'll use it. The cereal jumps into the bowl, the milk goes in after it, they all swim together in a beautiful synchronized routine, and then those Cheerios start jumping through the air and going into my mouth one at a time. My, that would be really great, but that's just not the way the world was created. I have to make a tremendous amount of effort to actually pour all that cereal into a bowl, add the milk on my own, no dancing, and bring the spoon to my mouth. That's called hishtadlus. Hishtadlus shows up everywhere in our lives. It's the basic effort that we need to live, to make money, to be healthy, to procreate. All those things require an amount of hishtadlus. The Chovos HaLevavos tells us that the reason why we have hishtadlus is because that's where free will exists. Whenever I have to make a choice to do something, do it, don't do it. Do it this way. Don't do it this way. All those things are a place where I can be making a free will choice, and free will choices are choices to either move closer to Hashem or farther away. But the point is that hishtadlus could bring a person to a place where he believes that he is the prime cause of all the things that are happening. So if a person makes money, he might believe that he makes money because he's actually accomplishing something, whereas in reality, a person makes money because Hashem has decreed that he should be making a certain amount of money. But he needs to do a basic level of hishtadlus to get that money from someone else's bank account into his bank account, hopefully in a legal way, and hopefully productive as well. But you could do something which is called too much hishtadlus. That is to say, there is a basic and understood minimum amount of effort that a person is supposed to do in order to reach a certain result, be it in health, be it in his finances. And when a person reaches that level of effort he's supposed to make, at that point, it does not make a difference whether he does more effort. That's what people like to call let go and let God. At that point, you stop the hishtadlus because you realize that at this point you've done the basic amount you need to do for Hashem to bring you the results that you're supposed to get. And it doesn't matter if you do more now. So when Moshe goes and he hits the rock a second time, right? According to the Ramban, hitting the rock the first time is just right, just perfect. That's how you get the water from the rock. At that point, he needs to stop. And whether or not the water is gushing out, trickling out, whatever it is, he needs to realize, Moshe Rabbeinu needs to realize that he's done his part. And now he needs to let Hashem take over. And Hashem has to figure out the way to get the water out of the rock if things haven't gone smoothly to this point. The problem is when he winds up and hits it a second time, that is showing a lack of faith in Hashem by doing too much hishtadlus, doing too much human effort, and not allowing Hashem to do his part. So we still have to understand, I mean, that's a really harsh punishment for what seems to be a pretty minimal or standard crime, quote-unquote, right? Just to do a bit too much hishtadlus, that's something that people do all the time. That's part of the human condition. Why is this case of doing too much hishtadlus so significantly problematic? Well, first of all, a point that we're going to be coming back to over and over is the fact that unlike the first occasion where Moshe strikes the rock, back at Horeb, there Moshe was told to do that miracle in front of 70 elders. And then, of course, he needed to have assistance to help all those elders get there. No, just kidding, not those kind of elders. In this case, Moshe has to gather the entire Jewish population, the Kahal, to come and watch the miracle. So there's something very different happening over here than in the first event. Let's see if we can figure it out a little bit more. There's a very nice approach of the Netziv over here in that, starting from this point in Bamidbar, Rashi points out that we're now at a turning point. We're now at a fork in the road. The old guard, the generation who made a mistake, who believed, the spies, they all pass away. They're gone. Those who remain from this point on in the Chumash are those who did not participate in the sin of the spies. All those people are going to merit to go into the land of Israel. So the Netziv says, look, it's very important. The verse pointed out to us, right, when we started, the very first verse of this chapter 20, points out that this is the first month, and Rashi points out the first month of the last year. So this is the kickoff of the final year in the desert. This is a year where none of the old guard remain. This is the new generation who was under 20 when the event of the spies occurred. All their education of what it means to be a person, an adult, came in the desert. So they don't have many of the challenges that the previous generation who came out of Egypt had faced. There's a challenge to that, though, and that they're about to come into the land of Israel. And living in the land of Israel is an entirely different experience than living in the desert. And that is because the desert life that they've known till now is entirely miraculous. But life in Israel will not be miraculous to the extent that life in the desert is. That is to say, in the desert, hishtadlus, this effort that you have to put in, almost doesn't exist. Right? Your food falls from the sky, your water comes out of rocks, and your laundry's done for you automatically by the miraculous cloud that constantly surrounds you. And life in Israel just isn't like that. And now, everything they're doing in this final year is a transition to prepare them to come back into a world of teva, of nature. So, this desert life, this holy, miraculous, effortless, cloud protecting me, laundry being done, ready, water everywhere type of a life, It needs to have a transition into it and a transition out of it. So it's very interesting to use this approach of the Netziv. We can actually create a nice endpoints, nice bookends to the two strikings of the rock. The first time leaving the land of Egypt, where water, well, came from the Nile, right? It just doesn't get more natural than that. You know where your water source is every morning. You walk over with your pail, swoop it up, and, right? That's where water comes from. It comes from the river. All of a sudden, water is going to be coming from a totally miraculous source. So Moshe has to show them how it's going to work. But here, right, the first time Moshe is going to hit the rock, Moshe is transitioning them into the world of the miraculous. You got to do some effort, right? You hit, you do something with the staff. But from there on, you're going to see how Hashem takes over. Normally you hit a rock, water doesn't come out. Today, it does. And from here on in. And the water, after that, flowed miraculously with no effort whatsoever. So now Moshe is reintroducing this idea of effort, right? Of making some effort and still seeing how Hashem does the rest for you, right? That's what life in Israel is going to be like. You're going to put seeds into the ground. They're going to decompose. And miraculously, they're going to grow stalks with hundreds of that same seed on the stalk. Oh my gosh, it's a miracle. No, that's nature, but it requires some effort. But yes, it is a miracle. It does come from Hashem ultimately. And that's the idea. That's the lesson we're starting to get reintroduced to right now. It's a transition back into taking that miraculous life, seeing that everything comes to Hashem, and bringing it back into a physical life that you're going to into the land of Israel. So now that this experience, right, that first experience wasn't even something that all the people could experience. Only the elders, those who are most spiritually sensitive, who could understand what they were watching, and then it would be filtered through them to the rest of the Jewish people, they were the only ones who watched that first miracle. But this second miracle, all these people, the whole people of Israel, this is the Dor HaDeah, this is the generation of knowledge, they understand, they're very spiritually sophisticated generation, they're all there to learn the lesson from Moshe on how to do Hishtadlus. And the problem is, that Moshe does too much Hishtadlus. So that means that here they came to witness this final lesson in Emuna, the great kickoff lesson in Emuna before starting this final year of transition into the land of Israel. And Moshe teaches them the wrong lesson. He does too much Hishtadlus. And if you see your Rebbe, if you see Moshe Rabbeinu, the person who's at the height of spiritual refinement, do too much Hishtadlus, that is a hard lesson to wipe out from your mind. And that is why it is so severe. Let's ask some questions on the Ramban, because we like asking questions. First of all, the Gur Aryeh does have a good, solid question in the Ramban. The Ramban tells us that any time you see the staff, it means that something's going to get hit. But the Gur Aryeh says, wait, actually, I do have one example for you where Moshe is clearly instructed to take the staff with him. Although we don't see the instruction, but we're told that Moshe says, I will take the staff with me. We assume he's instructed. And nothing in that instance is hit. And that is also in Parshas Beshalach over there, the war with the Amalek, the Amalekites, I guess that's how you would say it. Over there, Moshe takes the staff, and nothing's being struck. So that's one question from the Gur Aryeh on the Ramban. Second question is that our sages actually mention a cause for why Moshe and Aaron are punished. And that is Moshe's speech at the rock. We haven't seen anywhere, right? If we're taking the Ramban's approach, we do see that Moshe was asked to speak about the rock. But if we're not taking the Ramban's approach, then nowhere is Moshe commanded to say anything. No little speech. And not only that, the speech he does say to the Jewish people is a very angry speech. Right? Listen up, you rebels. Should we get some water out of this rock? So our sages understand that Moshe showed anger at that moment in time. And it was this showing anger that was problematic. Now the Ramban seems to be able to justify the speech in the way he's learning it, but our sages did not have a justification for that. So again, the Ramban is not bound to the sages in his approach to Pshat, but we generally do bind ourselves to the approach of the sages when it comes to Pshat, and that's why we're going to be more Rashi focused. Okay. The third question is, okay, so Moshe failed in the Amunah lesson, but we do need to understand, to try to justify why that means that he cannot go into the land now. I mean, is this some sort of a Mita Keneged Mita, like he didn't prepare the people right, so now he can't join them? And another question that anytime we try to understand what Moshe did to be punished over here is another very just philosophically difficult question, which is that whatever you do, if now you punish Moshe, you are actually, in effect, punishing the Jewish people. Because if they go into the land of Israel without Moshe, well, the most qualified person in the history of the world to take the Jewish people into the land of Israel is Moshe. As great as Yehoshua is, the fact that he is the next best possible option for us, he's just not Moshe Rabbeinu. So whatever it is, whatever punishment comes to Moshe, we have to understand why it's not, how that works, in that it seems like it's a punishment for the Jewish people as well. Okay, another question that we're going to have to ask, and the Ramban and Rashi, everybody's going to have to answer this question, is why exactly Aaron is punished. Now, if you remember, we saw that there's a few different approaches. Either Moshe hit the rock and he was supposed to speak to it, or Moshe hit the rock twice, or Moshe loses his temper and gives this angry speech to the people. And in all these three, it seems like Moshe's the chief acting character in this story. So why is Aaron being punished for what Moshe did wrong? Now Rashi actually is pretty clear. Rashi's always saying that everything was done in the plural, and seems to be saying that when Moshe went to, well, I mean, doesn't seem to be saying, he says it, when Moshe went to go speak to the rock, and nothing was happening. In that moment when he went to go speak to the rock, he looked at Aaron and he shrugged his shoulders, and they sort of spoke about it, and they said, well, I guess we should do what you did the first time and hit it. So whatever decision it was that Moshe came to, Moshe and Aaron came to that decision together. And therefore, if one's culpable, they're both culpable. And according to the Ramban, we'd have to say that something similar happened as well, which is that Moshe hit the rock once, and then they sort of looked at each other and were like, I guess we should hit it a second time. And that's why they're both held culpable. But the third scenario we brought up, that our sages mention, of the angry speech towards the people, that's also going to be problematic, because if Moshe got angry and he spoke to the people that way, well then, what does Aaron have to do with it? How was he supposed to stop Moshe from being angry? Moshe was angry, he just was. Okay, so the final question on Rashi, or on that approach of our sages, of course, is we need to understand why the two hittings of the rock are important if we're not going with the Ramban's approach. Okay. There's a beautiful Gurai over here. The Maharal really ties up a lot of loose ends by saying the following. Let's not try to pick one thing. Did they do this thing? Did they do that thing? That thing? It's all there. It's all in the text. Let's just read it straightforward. Okay? They hit the rock. twice. Moshe got angry at the people, right? All that happened. Which one was the one thing that he was punished for? It doesn't matter. Hashem says to Moshe, Ya'an lo emantim bi. You didn't believe in me. The root problem that was going on over here was a lack of emunah, a lack of belief. Now, a lot of people lack emunah. It's not something which is really punishable, right? How do you punish somebody for lacking emunah? But of course, here the point wasn't that he lacked emunah, but that these different actions, whatever it was that happened in the story, all these things gave the wrong impression to the Jewish people. The anger, the hitting twice, and all of that stemmed from a lack of emunah. Had the emunah been there, none of these actions would have been there. So unlike Chorev, what happened right at the beginning of Bashalach, where Moshe takes the 70 elders and hits the rock, as we mentioned, now all the Jewish people are being brought together. And the reason is because Hashem is coming to bring, wants to bring all the Jewish people to a level of emunah shlema, of complete belief. We can continue to build on the approach that we've been working on with the Netziv, right? They're coming into the land of Israel. It's a transition point. In order to come into the land of Israel, Hashem wants them to have emunah shlema. He wants them to have complete belief, complete emunah. Now, one thing that's important is when a person has complete emunah, then everything they do it besimcha. They're always happy because they know that whenever they do their part, Hashem does his part. And so if things seem to go wrong, that doesn't matter. It's nothing to get upset about because it's not my place to be able to have things go right or wrong. It's only my place to do my part. And here, Moshe and Aaron are performing a nes. They're performing a huge miracle. They are connecting to Hashem on the highest possible level, doing things which are impossible, and they are frustrated. They're meant to be showing the Jewish people that a rock can flow. It can give water. And this miracle, right? Whenever we talk about miracles, miracles aren't random. Hashem's not in a talent show trying to find whatever trick will grab your attention and be interesting. A miracle is a lesson, it's an idea. We're meant to learn something. Here, a rock, which is the most physical thing in the world, right? A rock doesn't grow. It doesn't have any will. It doesn't change without outside factors. And we're able to draw water from that. Water, which represents flow and chesed and Torah, right? From the most physical thing, we're able to bring out this beautiful spiritual reality. They have the moment, the opportunity to do that, and they're angry, and they're upset. And so when a person's not in a place of emunah, when he's not in a place of faith or trust, or however you want to translate that word, very hard to translate it, you get hasty. You say things you shouldn't say. You do too much ishtadlus, too much effort. So here, the Jewish people, they were meant to give the Jewish people their final lesson in hishtadlus in the land of Israel, making the effort in the land of Israel. You have to work, but it still has to come from Hashem. And they got angry. The final picture they have of Moshe and Aaron connecting spiritually is a place of frustration and anger. Okay. Now, I want to get a little bit philosophical in the question that we want to levy towards the Maharal right now. And it's all built in. It's not really a real question, but it's something to open up some windows for us into how to think. Moshe and Aaron, in doing what they need to do, have to face a pretty insurmountable challenge. It's something that we need to think about. The verse juxtaposed Miriam's death with the ending of the water supply in order to teach us that it was only in Miriam's merit the Jews had access to water in the first place. That is to say, there's something about Miriam's nature, her character, that causes the water to flow. Whatever it is, it's not Moshe. It's Miriam who has that merit. Moshe is something very different. As a matter of fact, we know that the three leaders of the Jewish people, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam, each one has a different merit. That is to say, the Jews merit a different miracle because of their presence. Miriam is the water that flows from the rock. And as we pointed out, rocks are very physical things. The rock represents the earth. Moshe is the opposite. Moshe represents the heavens, right? Moshe is as least physical as a human being can be and still be called a human and not an angel. And in his merit, we have the manna, which falls from the sky. It's a food which is so spiritual, it's as least physically physical as a physical food could be without it being spiritual food and still be physical. It comes from the heavens, right? When you eat it, it's used perfectly by your body. There's no waste, there's no refuse after eating the manna. It comes from nowhere. It's there when you need it. So Moshe and Miriam are at two polar opposites in their characteristics that bring about miracles for the Jewish people. And just to sort of bring out this idea a little bit more, let's think about this. There's an example, a famous example that's brought down when Moshe and Miriam both lead the Jewish people in song after the splitting of the sea. Moshe leads the men, Miriam leads the women. And in Moshe's version of the song of the sea, Moshe says, "Az Yashir." Then we will sing. Az Yashir Lashem. Then we will sing. What is then we will sing? Why are we saying then? Az Yashir with the Yud in front, pointing to the future. Az Yashir. So our sages tell us that Moshe saw in the splitting of the sea a glimpse of the Messianic era. And he said, "Wow, you see what we're experiencing now? Imagine what it's going to be like in the days of Mashiach. Az Yashir, we're really going to sing then." Miriam, on the other hand, said, "Shiru LaHashem. Sing to Hashem." That's what she said to the women. "Let's sing now." She wasn't worried about the future. She was worried about the present. And in that way, Moshe and Miriam very strongly represent the duality of the male-female nature. Men more easily connect to abstract concepts. They're more generally thinking about the future. They're scheming. They're planning. Women, on the other hand, the spiritual role of Nekeva, are more likely to appreciate the moment that's there before them. That's why Moshe says Az Yashir and Miriam says Shir LaHashem. And that's, of course, all part and parcel to the fact that Moshe is more connected upstairs to the heavens and Miriam is more connected downstairs to the earth. She's able to find the beauty and the spirituality here in the physical world. She can bring water from a rock, whereas Moshe struggles with seeing it here and needs to find it to transcend this world in order to see it and to find it. You see this also as you go further into this idea that in Egypt, Amram, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam's father, when Paro decrees that the Jewish males will be thrown into the Jordan, into the river, Amram separates from his wife because Amram is thinking about the future. How could I go ahead and bring a child into the world and have it risk death? And Miriam says to him, "Why are you thinking about the future? The future is Hashem's job. You need to live in the present. You know how much beauty you could bring into the world? If you bring another Jewish child into the world, you've done something beautiful. Whatever Paro does afterwards, that's Hashem's problem. It's not your problem. And again, we see when Moshe separates from his wife, Moshe separates from the feminine aspect in order to connect more holy upstairs. Who's deeply disturbed by that? Miriam. Miriam, at the end of Parshas Bahaloscha, ends up speaking against Moshe because she can't understand why Moshe would separate from his wife, from his feminine aspect, in order to be more connected into the masculine aspect. So those are two wildly divergent worlds. The world of Moshe, it's very masculine, it's very abstract, it's very in Shemayim, it's very spiritual, it's very not connected to the physical world. Miriam's reality is very much entrenched in the physical world. She's able to find the spirituality in all things physical. So now, Hashem is asking Moshe to do what Miriam was doing before for the 40 years in the desert. And how can we fairly expect Moshe to be able to do it if he's not built for that sort of a miracle? You could ask me to dunk a basketball for the salvation of the Jewish people, and I could do my best and I could try as hard as I wanted to, but it wouldn't work because I cannot dunk a basketball. So Hashem here is turning to Moshe and he's saying, I want you to be a Miriam. So how do we want Moshe to be able to accomplish that? He can't do that. He lacks the tools in order to be able to do that. Let's just finish up this idea a little bit, and we'll go back, in that we do see something very fascinating in trying to understand why Hashem is doing this. It's going to answer, actually, a lot of very big lingering questions for us. First of all, Miriam dies right before all this happens. Why? Why did Miriam die? She didn't do anything wrong. She didn't participate in the sin of the spies. There's nowhere written anywhere that she made any sort of transgression why she would die. Why wouldn't she go into the land of Israel with Moshe and Aaron? And another important question is, when in the entire Chumash have we ever seen that Hashem asks Moshe and Aaron together to perform a miracle? Now, where there were times in Egypt where Aaron performed the miracle because Moshe was not allowed to perform two of the miracles, striking the Nile and striking the sand. But other than that, miracles are pretty much Moshe's realm. He's our spiritual teacher. He's Moshe Rabbeinu. He's our Rebbe. When it comes to miracles, he does the miracles. Aaron's really good at explaining stuff, you know, getting high ideas over to the people. He's the spokesman. Why is he involved in this miracle at all? It's very unusual. So in order to answer these two questions, we could say the following notion. And we're building up on this idea, right? The Jewish people are preparing to transition and to head into the land of Israel. The land of Israel is a place where a Moshe approach is very difficult, because it's not a place of spirituality transcended and separated from the physical world. Rather, it's a place where you have to find that spirituality in the world. So which is it? Are you meant to be a Moshe when you go into the land of Israel? Or are you meant to be a Miriam when you go into the land of Israel? And possibly, Hashem is telling Moshe now, I want you to be both. I need you to show the people that you could be a Moshe, connected so high up in the spiritual world that you feel detached from physicality, And I want you to simultaneously be a Miriam. That you're so connected to the physical world that you see spirituality in everything physical. I want you to encompass that in one person. That is the ideal picture of a Jew who goes into the land of Israel. I want you to be both. Now, why is Aaron there? What's he have to do with it? Why is it his business? So we spoke about what was in Miriam's merit, and that's the water that comes from the stone. Moshe's merit, that's the manna that comes from the heavens. In Aaron's merit, the Jewish people had the clouds of glory. What is a cloud? A cloud is an intermediary. It is the space where the waters below and the heavens above share a mutual existence. Aaron is a bridge. The Kohanim, a Kohen, represents the idea of shalom, of peace, as we will see or have seen last year in Pinchas, I believe we spoke about it, that Aaron is Oev Shalom and Rodev Shalom. He brings together husbands and wives. He used to bring together people who were quarreling. Aaron has the ability to take the feminine aspect and the masculine aspect and help them to link up, just like he does in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, that he brings the Jewish people together to Hashem, right, through all the service that he does there. So why was Aaron there? Aaron was there because Hashem needed him there to help Moshe get it right. Hashem understood that this is an impossible task. And therefore Hashem said, listen, Moshe, I'm going to help you. I'm going to give you Aaron as well because he understands the Miriam reality better than you understand it. And with that, we answer a lot of questions. We understand why Aaron was here. And we understand why Aaron's equally culpable along with Moshe. Because he was meant to help Moshe get it right. That's the whole reason he was there. Hashem was relying on them both to be able to figure out the problem of getting Moshe to be able to act like a Miriam. Ultimately, though, we see that Moshe is not a Miriam. He can't be a Miriam. He's just not. So at that point, what was he supposed to do? Says the Maharal, that is exactly the entire point of the lesson that Moshe was meant to teach the Jewish people. Emunah is always a process of trying to grab something that is slightly beyond your reach. Right? We don't rely on Hashem. When the sun rises in the morning and you said, I knew that was going to happen, that's not a display of your Emunah. Emunah is a process that's always just beyond your reach. The reason why you have faith, why you trust your spouse, that tomorrow she's not going to come home and abandon you, that you know she's going to support you in the difficult times, meaning I hope that that's your situation. Your parents, someone who has a parent who has always stuck by them, even in situations which you have not yet experienced, even ones that may be harder than you can imagine because, you know, there are smaller situations and bigger situations. You have faith, trust, that your parents will be there supporting you. Well, that trust didn't start yesterday. That trust started when you're a baby. And your parents fed you because you couldn't feed yourself. And your parents clothed you because you couldn't clothe yourself. And then your parents taught you to walk because you didn't know how. And at every step, you saw, wow, I can rely on my parents for this. Can I rely on my parents for the next step? And each time in that relationship, the parent shows you that you could always rely on them. Your trust, your faith in them grows to the point where now you can move into new situations, and even though your parents haven't proven themselves in this situation, you know based on your relationship with them that they will be there for you, that your spouse will be there for you, that your best friend will be there for you. That's what it's like in our relationship with Hashem. We're always going to be in new and changing situations in life, in health, in finance. And emunah isn't something I yet experienced. That's not called emunah, right? Hashem's already proven that. Emunah is relying on Hashem for the areas which I have not yet seen, which I have not yet explored. Moshe has never done this before. It's possible that he cannot even do it, that it's beyond his grasp. But, says the Maharal, if he's able to do it with emunah, that means no matter how much things seem to be going wrong, I'm doing what I understand I'm supposed to do. I'm filled with simcha. And with everything going wrong, with the Jewish people heckling you, right? What's going on? Where's our water? This rock, that rock. You're talking to the rock, or you hit the rock once for going with the Ramban. And things just aren't going your way, but you remain happy and calm because you know that you're doing what Hashem wants you to do. So at that point, when the miracle occurs, the greatest thing Moshe Rabbeinu taught the Jewish people wasn't the miracle itself, rather was this tremendous lesson in emunah, showing that you could be happy and connected and complete and whole even when doing tasks that are beyond your ability to accomplish. And that's where Moshe and Aaron fall short in teaching that lesson. And that's really just a beautiful, finger-licking, wonderful Maharal. Now, the one thing that we're going to point out here, because the Maharal himself also points out, that this is a very beautiful pshat. It's basically a rebooted Ramban. Basically takes the idea of the Ramban, the idea from the sages, and he bumps them up another notch by broadening the picture for us, that it's about emunah. It's not about one specific action or another specific action. Brings in the idea of bringing the Jewish people to this completed state of emunah, the importance of emunah, of doing things that bring you close to Hashem with joy. But as the Ramban himself is going to point out, it is not Rashi. It's not Rashi. Rashi tells us very clearly what the mistake was for which Moshe and Aaron are being punished. And that's the fact that Moshe hits the rock at all as opposed to speaking to it. And if we would have left Rashi just there, we could have really built the Maharal into it. But Rashi himself goes further. And he explains exactly why it's a problem that they spoke to the rock, that they hit the rock, rather than speak to the rock. Hashem says, "You didn't believe in me to sanctify me before the Jewish people." So Rashi understands the bigger problem wasn't the lack of emunah, rather that the sanctification of Hashem didn't happen. Now, why did the sanctification of Hashem not happen? The water came out of the rock, right? That was the whole point. The rock was going to be our water pinata. We were going to hit it, and water was going to... Well, okay, we were going to talk to it, and water was going to shoot out. Instead, we hit it, but ultimately, the miracle happened. In what way is Hashem's name not sanctified? So Rashi tells us, had you spoken to the rock, and the water had come out, then I would have been sanctified in front of the congregation. And they would have said, "Ma sela zeh? Wow, behold this rock. She'enu medaber ve'enu shomea. Doesn't speak, doesn't hear. Ve'enu tzarech leparnasa. Doesn't need money, doesn't need parnasa, doesn't need to be sustained. Mekayim diburo shel mokom kal v'chomer anu. It fulfills the will of Hashem. How much more should we do the same?" And at this point, we can go back to the Ramban's question, right? This is really where the Ramban asks his question. Rashi's telling us that had they spoken to the rock, the Jewish people would have been able to make this Kal V'chomer. Right? The rock does Hashem's will, how much more should I? And the question again comes up, which is, well, why do we care if you hit the rock or you spoke to the rock? The Jewish people could learn that idea either way, right? The rock, which is just a rock, does what Hashem wants. We were more than a rock. How much more so we should do what Hashem wants, whether you speak to it or whether you hit it. So first of all, the Gur Aryeh points out that this is not about the rock. It's about the Jewish people. And the Jewish people are smart. And the Jewish people know how miracles work. That is to say, miracles aren't random. They're meant to teach us very specific ideas. So if Hashem does a miracle in a specific way, there's a specific message we are meant to take out of that. We are meant to learn from that. So you're right. When Moshe hits the rock, the water still comes out. But the Kal V'chomer, the lesson that the Jewish people take out from that, is the wrong lesson. Real emunah is a matter of love. It's a matter of motivating myself to do things because they're the right thing. When you speak to the rock, when you tell the rock what you want it to do, Moshe and Aaron, and the rock on its own begins to gush forth water, the Jewish people say, whoa, that is one self-motivated rock. Hashem just asked it to do something, and it did it. But if you hit the rock, then you have not taught the Kal V'chomer, you taught the wrong Kal V'chomer. Now the Jewish people understand that, oh, look at that rock. Hashem's teaching us that we can't accomplish anything unless an outside force acts upon us. Now that might be true in physics, right? When Newton tells us that you need an action to create a reaction, but human will is not like that. A human can be self-motivated to decide to do the right thing without an outside force acting on him. That's a decision made from love, not out of fear. So now we have, according to Rashi, a really, really big problem. Moshe was meant to be giving them the final lesson in Emunah, teaching them as they're about to go into the land of Israel, that a person can be so connected to Hashem, he could serve him out of true love, that even without any outside force, a person can choose to do the right thing. No need for punishments, no need for reward. You can make the right decision because you love Hashem. Instead, he ends up teaching them the lesson that unless you get whacked by Hashem, you're not going to be able to do the right thing. And that's a very big problem. Okay. So ultimately, just to wrap it up, the big question of tying together what Moshe does wrong and the punishment he receives for it, we could actually use everything we've built up until this point and connect it to a well-known Or HaChaim in Parshas Va'eschanan, where there the Or HaChaim brings a few different sources from our sages, from the Oral Torah, that if Moshe would come into the land of Israel, it would bring about the Messianic era. That is to say, if Moshe builds the Holy Temple, it's not like any other Holy Temple that we've ever seen, like the first one or the second one. It cannot be destroyed. Just like the Mishkan couldn't be destroyed, it had to be buried. So too the third temple, or the temple Moshe would have built, could not be destroyed. Now that's not necessarily a problem unless you understand the following idea. When the Jewish people are in the land of Israel, and God's presence is with them, it's all wonderful if we're behaving the way that we need to behave. But if the Jewish people aren't on the right level, and they're not behaving on the way that in the way that they need to behave, then they cannot dwell in the same space as the Beis HaMikdash. That means you have two options. You can destroy the Beis HaMikdash, or you can destroy the Jewish people. In that way, we saw with the first and the second temple that we were fortunate that they could be destroyed. Hashem took his wrath out on the temple and not on the people, and the Jewish people continue. But had Moshe gone into the land of Israel, you need a very specific type of Jewish people to go in with him, because if they're not ready for the Messianic era, they will be destroyed. So now, this is the event in which Moshe Rabbeinu gets told that he's not allowed to come into the land. Now, if it's because the Jewish people aren't ready to come into the land of Israel, then what we've said is that Hashem has basically just set up Moshe for failure to find some way to get him out of the way so he won't harm the Jewish people. Rather, we could look at it in the following way. In order for the Jewish people to be able to come into the land, Hashem says, there is one way that we could bring them to the right level to go in with you, Moshe, to bring about the Messianic era and the final Beis HaMikdash. And that is, if you can pull off this miracle, Moshe, incorporate the Miriam aspect into your own character, have the Jewish people witness it and see that, they'll make this Kal V'Chomer. They'll say, whoa, look at that rock. That's pure love, man. That's the real thing. That's true love. And if you could get the Jewish people to that level, then you go in, they go in, Messiah comes, everyone's happy. Once, however, Moshe is not able to teach them this lesson, at that point, going into the land of Israel with Moshe is only bad for them. So, are we punishing them when we punish Moshe? Well, ultimately, really, everybody's fate is inextricably bound because Moshe is the teacher of the Jewish people, right? The Jewish people had three teachers. And that means this is our best shot to become something greater. And all our chips are in with Moshe, because he's the one who's helping us through this transformation. And if Moshe can do it, we can do it. And if we can't do it, if he can't do it, then we can't do it. And that's why ultimately, when Moshe loses his ability to come into the land of Israel, we lose ours as well. Okay, there's so much more to say about this, but we've reached our time, so I guess we'll save it for next year. Have a wonderful Shabbos.